The date today is the 18th of April, and I'm sitting in my kitchen with Mario Peretta. And Mario started to tell me so many wonderful stories. I made him stop because I need to have these on the tape.
Okay.
So, Mario, would you just start by talking to me about where your family lived and when, all in what we now call Harbor Village.
Okay, so essentially, 1957 is clearly when my parents arrived in Toronto, at least in this neighborhood. But my uncle Giorgio Giannone had arrived earlier, and in his entrepreneurial exactness, or at least the strength that he had as a woodworker, managed to buy up an enormous number of properties, of which we ended up living in one of them, on the main floor only, though, because he had now given the second floor to another one of his siblings, his sister, which was fine, but it was a little complicated. But that's just the way life was in those days.
How was it complicated?
Well, complicated because I think my uncle wasn't terribly close to his sister and or his sister's husband. And he tended to be a little bit more of what they call the mafioso type. So he came from Sicily, of course, and felt that the world owed him an enormous amount. And the world, of course, owed him nothing. And he was a very abusive man, and we didn't like him very much. And it didn't take very long before my uncle ousted him out of there, and he went to live...
Giorgio ousted
him and his sister out. And at that point, a number of years had gone by now, and my dad had decided to buy some real estate. And it just so happened that Giorgio, my uncle, of course, had 93 Harbor Street, which, of course, was an interesting building because we had a grocery store on the main floor, of which my dad could work in, which was owned by Giorgio. And we started to live on the second floor of 93 Harbor Street, which was rather convenient because, of course, we didn't have to go very far. But everything was actually very tight in those days because imagine your typical Victorian row house and or typical Victorian building never encompassed more than 3 bedrooms. So, of course, my mom and dad would live in one. That occupied one. There were now 2 left. We were 4 boys, and my brothers and I shared beds. So, namely, I slept with my brother Nick, who's now passed away, as you know, and my brother Pat and Sal slept in another bed. And that was the arrangement. At that point, my dad had now decided that he kind of wanted to venture out on his own, didn't really want to work for my uncle. My uncle was kind of a tough man, very hard to deal with, very exacting personality, incredible craftsman, great woodworker. But my dad went out to work in construction and worked in the bricklaying and concrete slash mortar business, and hooked up with a whole bunch of other Italians, of course, who were also working, and managed to, you know, scrape up whatever monies he needed. And at that point, we bought 97 Harbor Street.
Now, what's at that point? What year are you talking about?
97 Harbor Street would now have been probably in the late 60s, late 60s, 67, 68, roughly. So from 57 to 68, 10 years had gone by. So we had started living on Robert Street. From Robert Street, we went to 93 Harbor Street. Dad worked with my uncle at that point as well. Also, and my uncle had a shop.
This is Giorgio.
Giorgio had a woodworking shop, and Giorgio was responsible, for example, for a lot of the woodworking that went into the Calderon shoe shops, that went into the Eaton Center, all the fine woodworking that took place in their floor exhibits or whatever it was.
So this was fine. He was commissioned to do
and
very successful.
And he had been a very interesting Jewish man called Mr. Appleby, who I'll never forget. He was a very short man, somewhat overweight, but he seemed to be a maverick. He was connected with everybody and anything, and he knew how to do business. And he connected my uncle with all the right people, and they just somehow made it all happen and make it all work. My dad didn't want anything to do with it anymore because he had a hard time working with my uncle. Mm-hmm. He admired him and respected him, but my dad was a very simple man, and he was a bit more of an artsy kind of more laid back kind of man. He wasn't terribly opinionated. He wasn't loud. He was never in your face. He didn't have an inflated ego, where my uncle was absolutely the opposite. He was Valentino being reborn, essentially, really.
So it was hard for your father to...
It was very hard for him. In fact, they just never really got along.
So that was his brother-in-law.
His brother-in-law. But my uncle George was also somebody who loved everybody, and he wanted the best for everybody. So, you know, all of his... benessere, meaning all of his goodness, was always respected. So he was never somebody who ever lacked any kind of respect. But he did so much for everybody.
But his style was so different from your father.
But he is totally different. My dad was just not as anal retentive. He wasn't as obsessive about things.
Lower key.
Much. My dad was a farmer. My dad grew vegetables. My dad grew grains. They did crop rotation. He would tell me all about it.
And your uncle was an entrepreneur.
My uncle was an entrepreneur at a very, very young age. We were in a small town in Sicily. Before you could say boo, my uncle George was in Palermo, big city, working for a fine woodworker, cabinet maker, making French provincial furniture, for crying out loud. I mean, there was no end what he was capable of doing. But he had an ego that was the size of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so it was hard for your father to be...
Yeah, my father was just not that type of man, and didn't like the feeling of competition and felt there was competitiveness, and moved into his own circles and ended up making his own way. And in construction, of course, what else is new? Because Italians... what am I doing for a living? I'm in construction as we speak. So,
But you've done woodwork too.
Well, I got the woodworking from my uncle, because as a child, I would walk into the woodworking shop, and so did my brothers, and we would watch him running lathes and building furniture, and he housed, my God, I don't know how many lawyers' offices. We used to go in, he used to gather, because he never had kids. My uncle and his aunt, my aunt, my mother's sister had a hysterectomy at a very young age. She had a tumor, and it was removed, and she couldn't have kids. They adopted a child many years afterwards, but in essence, they adopted us because we were, you know, my aunt and my mother were sisters, of course, and we were kind of like kids for them.
Uh-huh. So you had extra parents.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, my Uncle George was an incredibly powerful influence for us. So it's not by any fluke that I happen to be a woodworker.
Well, I know that when you shut the restaurant, you were doing
that. I mean, I did all that work for Macis. I mean, everything.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's beautiful. Yeah, the bar, the ceilings, the walls. I did all
gorgeous.
Of that work.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. That was all me.
So you're not doing that anymore?
Oh, no, I still am.
Oh, you were doing that and?
But now what I'm doing is I'm working for high-end architects that do custom design homes in Forest Hill and Rosedale.
Oh, so you are doing exactly
that. Oh, yeah, I'm still doing it.
Okay.
Look at these hands.
Working man's hands.
Yeah, and I love it. And I would never think twice.
Yeah, but you love the work.
Oh, I love it.
Well, you have your Uncle George to thank for that.
Yeah. Well, who on earth could this possibly be? So back to Giorgio. Wow, what a guy. So love him to tears. He did pass away recently, and much to his dream, he passed away with no pain, because he had a massive heart attack in Sicily. He had moved back. He could not handle the cultural diversity of Toronto and needed to be in a very, very intense Italian environment. And he had...
How many years was he here?
George left in 1981. And he had come in the early 50s, 54, 55, in that area.
Uh-huh.
He was here about two to three years earlier than we arrived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he was he mentally couldn't take it anymore, and needed to walk out into streets and communicate with the world at large, which is something he could never do here.
Yeah.
And he felt very isolated, very depressed.
Oh, that's true. But he really helped a lot of people adjust when they first came, of your family.
He was the
family.
Man. Uh-huh. He was the man.
When your family lived there, you talked about your parents. You have had three brothers. Nick has died, unfortunately. But it was two boys in each bed.
Yeah.
You lived on one floor, you said?
Only on one floor.
So what happened on the other floor or floors? Who was there?
This is at 206 Robert Street there.
Okay.
At 93 Harvard Street, we only had the second floor because the first floor was in a supermarket. It was all, and then we moved over to Joe Polacco. My father would call him Joe Polacco. And Joe was a Jewish Polish man who owned a Polish butcher shop where 97 Harvard Street is now.
Okay.
So we took over that building and made a restaurant on the main floor.
Called
Peretta's.
Uh-huh.
And on the second floor, of course, it was the same layout. There were three bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Mom and Dad would sleep in one. Nick and I would sleep in one. Pat and Sal would sleep in the other. And that's just the way it was. And I did not get my own bed until I was, I think, 16, 15 or 16. Nick and I shared that bed. In fact, interestingly, I never forget, you know, going to bed and watching The Untouchables with Elliot Ness at 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night. And my brother Nick was so into this show. Of course, I was so much younger than he was.
How much younger?
4 or 5 years at least. And I'd be like passed out for the most part.
But he would have it. The television was in your bedroom?
So imagine my mom's bedroom was here, and Nick and I slept adjacent to mom and dad.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a bathroom, and in the next room, Sal and Pat slept in that. So essentially, if my mom and dad had to go to the bathroom, they had to literally walk either on top of us or within like a 12-inch space to get around this double fold-out couch bed to go to the bathroom. But 9 times out of 10, because I was quite young, I would complain about sleeping, and I would walk into my mom's room, of course, and I would crawl into her side of the bed, and she would curl me up into a ball and I'd fall asleep, and then she would pick me up and throw me back in bed again. And that was a typical, until I at least, I think, I don't know, I must have been like maybe 10 or 11 at that point where I changed that regimen. But my mother and I were very close. I was the baby of the family, and she was the most unbelievable woman. I mean, she would do anything and everything she could to make our lives decent and wonderful. And she did. And she did a great job.
Well, there were six of you.
She was incredible.
Yeah.
My God.
Was she involved with the business?
Absolutely. So, okay. So when my dad finally decided to open up the restaurant, my dad was still working in construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would, of course, he'd be out the door at 6:30 or whatever it was, or 6, we never saw half of him. And he would arrive back, I guess around 4 or so. And my mother would often arrive a little bit later because she didn't have the same early hours, because she worked at King and Spadina.
What was she doing there?
She actually worked for a wonderful Jewish man. What was the name of the building? I think it was called the Krangle Building, if I'm not mistaken. And she was responsible for making photographic cardboard cards. In other words, you slip your photograph into the cardboard thing that flips open, that has a little backrest so you can lean it over. And she used to often come home crying because, of course, she was in great competition with other Italian women who would steal her work. But her boss loved her. In fact, what are their names? In fact, I know them because the daughter is a real estate agent that works at Forest Hill Real Estate, where my brother Nick worked. And I've forgotten her last name. But I'll remember eventually. Anyhow, so my mom formed an amazing relationship with this man who owned this company. And so she would come home, of course, from work. Dad would come home from work. We'd focus on trying to get food into our bodies because we were all hungry. And then we would focus on trying to get the restaurant ready. And all of us, every day, all four of my brothers and my mom and dad, at about 6 o'clock in the evening, would open up the restaurant. And we would work and run the restaurant until 11, 12 o'clock at night.
Mother had a full-time job. Your father had a full-time job. And he was out at 6 in the morning.
Yeah, and they didn't... my father laid my mother off, or at least told her she didn't have to work anymore after the first year or so, because there was a little bit of money coming in by way of the restaurant so that she didn't have to go and work. But my dad kept doing work because, I mean, he was making some decent money, and he would also take on projects on the weekends as well. And then eventually, I think in 1974, 75, I was probably turning about 15 or 16 at the time. He finally quit his job, and he and my mom split.
You want to cry?
Anyway,
these are very personal stories.
So they
were hardworking people.
They opened up without two jobs.
They opened up,
and they had no more two jobs.
They finally had the restaurant.
And it was amazing because they had their autonomy. They finally had their autonomy. And so at that point, we were all entering high school. Sorry about that. We were all entering high school. And so it was a tough time because, you know, we wanted to have delivery, and none of us had our driver's licenses yet. So we delivered our pizza on bicycles.
And I'll
never forget, I was in grade 9, and I was being taught by Mr. Borensheen, who was from Dresden, of all places, and I made boxes out of galvanized steel. Go ahead.
No.
And so we had our bicycles, and we were delivering pizza on bicycles, until my brother Sal, finally, the oldest of the family, turned 16, and he'd get his driver's license, and we bought our first Austin Mini. And that was our first delivery car. Sorry, I just put
and
down
what
that.
Year was that?
That would have been 1975, then 76, in that area. Early 70s. And anyhow, so that business started to really grow. And then eventually Pat got his license, and then eventually Nick got his license, and we could take care of that. I was a lot younger, of course, so we'd all come home from school, and we all had our responsibilities. My brothers and I, we all divided our work in regards to what we were capable of doing. So we used to make dough by hand. There was no dough machine, so we take turns on our hands and knees of making dough.
Oh my god!
Oh yeah!
Huge quantities.
70 pounds each
on your
shot.
Hands and knees.
On our hands
right
and knees.
Right up to your elbows.
Yeah, physically making it, and we didn't get our dough machine. I forget it until about 5 or 6 years later. And at that point, I was coming close to finishing high school.
But that was a major family effort.
Oh, my
God. There
were
six of you rolling up your sleeves and making this business happen.
Yeah. So, you know, everything needed to be done. The day you come home from school, and their cheese needed to be grated, and peppers needed to be cut, and mushrooms needed to be cut.
Wow.
All this, my mother would make trays and trays of lasagna. We had the university students loved this, of course. You know, she'd have, you know, they'd, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon at that point, oh my God, she'd have trays of lasagna and meatballs and sausages and all this stuff. And, you know, everyone from St. Vladimir's Institute, everybody from Trinity College, these kids would all line up. And they would just go completely crazy. And they ate so much of our food. It was unbelievable. So the business just grew. And it grew so fast.
And all six of you continued to work there.
Yeah, for a long time. And then, you know, as time went by, of course, you know, I'd finished high school. I went into university. My brother Nick, you know, felt that he didn't really continue. He didn't want to really do it anymore. Mm-hmm. He had his time with it. But we still had mortgages and debts to pay off. And my oldest brother, Sal, he didn't really have much ambition, but yet he was a very passionate individual, loved his music, and is a great piano player. The restaurant business for him was perfect because he didn't have to sell his soul to the business, and he could still pursue the love of music. Mm-hmm. So it gave
so
him...
it worked well
for it worked
him.
Really well for him. And my brother Pat, of course, really had a tough time with it too, because he didn't, you know, he just thought it was time for him to branch off as well. Now, in my situation, what happened was I was now in first year engineering school, and my dad approached me and said, you know, your brother Nick has left, your brother Pat wants nothing to do with it. Your brother Sal is fine, except your brother Sal is not going to run this business, and I'm getting close to retirement. I want to know if he would be interested in taking over the restaurant. And I said, Dad, you know, I'd like to really finish my degree, and but I also recognize that we still have debts to pay. Because our last big renovation in 1979, 1980, if you can imagine, in those days, it was over $300,000. It was a lot of money. And we still hadn't paid it all off, and my dad really was not... And my mother's varicose veins had gotten out of hand, and she couldn't work in the restaurant. And so I said, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to finish my degree. And I took over the business.
And so you sacrificed your university education at that time.
Yeah, totally. And
was that a hard decision?
Yeah, I'm a little pissed at it, you know, to this day, yeah. Because I thought, you know, my dad, I thought he had made a mistake. I think he, at that point, he should have, you know, moved forward in a different kind of way, and Sal should have just, you know, done his thing.
Because he wasn't interested in going to university.
No, not in the least. But, you know, at the same time, I felt a very strong responsibility, because it's not like Nick or Pat asked for a way out. They just basically said, we're out of here. Mm-hmm. And they left. So my dad was caught kind of between a rock and a hard place. The business needed to continue. Money still needed to come in the door. Sal was willing to do it, and I was basically the last vestige left. So I felt a strong obligation.
Yeah, it sounds as if you felt as if you didn't have a choice.
I didn't have a choice.
That's my take on it. Yeah.
So I took it over, and back in 1986, 85, 86, roughly. So I finished grade 13, I remember, 1982.
Wow, you were young when you took over.
Yeah, I was very young.
Woo.
Yeah, huge responsibility at a very young age. And it was tough, because some of the employees at the time were almost twice my age, and so the pecking order, at least the whole power struggle, was quite tough. But I was a tough kid, and we came from hard times, and we weren't afraid. I mean, you got to bear in mind that when we grew up in this neighborhood, you know, it wasn't that uncommon to be having fist fights. I mean, it was just the way it was.
Let's move on to that. Okay.
It was a tough period.
So who was fighting with whom?
It was actually a really interesting time, because I think that because we were all immigrants, there were territorial stakes that everybody was taking out, whether you were Italian or Jewish or Portuguese or Canadian or whatever the case may be. So everybody was trying to make their mark. And interestingly enough, we kind of all came together by the end of it all. We all lived to tell the tale, but we were all looking to find some level of validation, because we didn't have any identity. We were all immigrants.
Yeah.
But it was tough. It was tough because I can remember, you know, for example, bands of kids getting together and going stealing. And going stealing meant that, you know, there were going to be three or four of us or five of us. And my dad, of course, would never condone this. He would never, ever, ever. If he had ever found out that we did anything like this, he would freak out. So we tended not to steer away, not to fall into that trap, because the fright of my father and my mother would have been way, way more intense.
So they were formidable when they chose to be.
And much more severe. Uh-huh. But it wasn't uncommon to see, you know, a bunch of guys going out and ripping people off. And whether it was stealing car radios out of cars, or whether it was breaking into homes, or and that was just the type of neighborhood that it was. It was rough.
You're talking about the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, I'm talking about...
And that's what the adolescents were doing.
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s. So it was tough. And imagine the character makeup of a child who's out there, and the amount of fear involved in going out and stealing and having people staking out a house or staking out a car and making sure no one's watching, and the police and da-da-da-da. So they were fairly ferocious young kids, which also, of course, meant that they were not necessarily alpha males, but there was a hell of a lot more testosterone than you could swing a stick at, so that if you were not careful, you know, you were going to get beaten up.
Yeah.
So my brother Nick, for example, his first day at Central Tech, back in the early 70s, 72, 73, came back with two black eyes.
Oh.
Wasn't uncommon at all.
So you're saying...
It was tough.
So you're saying you took over the restaurant, you were very young, but you had grown up... in circumstances where you had to be tough.
Oh, God.
So when you were the youngest kid on the block, so to speak, in the store, and you were the boss, you rose to the occasion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we had learned so early on, just so early on, not to be afraid and to fight and to stand up on your own two feet. I mean, you were not an Italian. You were a WOP. And that's just the way it was. It's no different than you were a Jew.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, you know, Johnny Fuda and I, like I told you before, we'd go into the Harvard Bakery and Goldie would give us donuts and stuff. But, you know, the number of times the Harvard Bakery got broken into, you have no idea. Oh, my.
By these scoops that you just described.
Oh, not just them, but God knows what. And they were also persecuted because they were Jewish. It was horrible. It was horrible. But it was also, there was still enough community. I mean, otherwise, I mean, I'm sure that Albert and Rose and Goldie would have left, but they didn't because they realized that there was enough goodness still in the neighborhood.
That's Harvard Bakery, for the sake of the tape. Albert and Goldie mean Harvard Bakery.
Yeah, Albert and Goldie. Anyway, that's how I know them.
Of course, yeah.
I was just a child, you know, they were there.
But, so you're saying that there were a lot of gangs. You were Italian... The Italian kids, adolescents, hung out with each other. The Jewish ones did the same.
But the Italians and the Jews got along. There was a kind of a really strong family kind of feeling. And that is that our parents kind of created the viaducts for us. So that, for example, on our streets, on Robert Street, for example, there was Joe Stein. Of course, you've heard of Joe Stein because you lived in Johnny Fuda's house.
Yes.
Okay, so Joe Stein lived in that house. And he was a tailor. And, of course, Joe Stein would come every day to the restaurant, and he would have a soup or a minestrone or a coffee or whatever it was and loved to chain smoke. And but in those days, you know, my dad would hire him to make us clothes. He would come in and say, "You need anything from me?" It's like, "What do you got?" You know, it's like, "So we need some, you need some slacks? Okay." He'd have his tape measure on him. He'd measure my...
Right in the restaurant?
Oh, yeah. He would walk in, measure my dad's waist. So he made pants for my dad. He made us pants. He made us shirts. Whatever we wanted. So
you're saying the Jewish people and the Italian people, for the most part, did get along?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. There was no question.
The children and the parents.
Yeah, yeah, there was no question. There was never going to be animosity. Ever, ever. I think that it was really... The problems took place with the... English Canadians.
Ah.
That's where the true problems took place. But most of the Italians, and even to some degree the Portuguese or the Jews, we didn't really have to fight for each other that much. I think we had enough of our own hardships. But I think a lot of the Canadians that had already been here and had grown up in these neighborhoods that didn't really have very much, they were really struggling to protect their state.
Well, but you just touched on something that's important, because this neighborhood at that time, people, as you say, didn't have very much.
No.
Right now, it's a very different situation.
Oh, God,
people
yeah.
are buying these houses for a lot of money, so different kinds of people are moving in.
We bought 97 Harvard Street from Joe Polacco, and in those days, didn't have to take a mortgage out, took a vendor take back, and if, you know, depending on whether we had a great month or a bad month, you know, Joe was like, "Well, if you can't pay me this month, don't worry about it. You pay me next month." You know.
And what kinds of prices? Do you have any idea?
Oh, yeah. We bought 97 Harvard Street for $21,000.
What year was that?
1968.
Oh, my God.
$21,000. Anyhow, so it was a vendor take back, and he was fine with it, and my dad was fine with it, and it was fine. It was just the way it was. But generally, the neighborhood at that point was still, you know, it was about 50-50. It was about 50% Italian and 50% Jewish. There weren't that many Canadians at that point. Most of the Canadians had moved up. And the Jewish community was also moving out. But they were moving out a little slower. They weren't in such a hurry. So there were a number of families on the street. And the Steins were still on the street. And I can remember all these wonderful people. There was another Jewish family at the corner of Wilcox and Robert. And I'm just trying to remember their last name. There was Kane. I don't know, but that doesn't sound Jewish, but she was Jewish. C-A-I-N. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was about, I'd say about 50-50.
So you're saying, from what you remember, it was the Jewish people and the Italian people in the 70s were the...
Early 70s.
Yeah. What changes happened after that in terms of ethnicity?
Well, most of the Jews at that point had moved out. I mean, post-1975, 76, 77, they were slowly making their way out. And they made way for the Portuguese community that started to come in. A lot of the Portuguese had settled, I guess, on Dundas Street, Dundas and Ossington. But there were a number of families that moved in to Robert Street. And at that point, most of the Jewish community was already gone. That would have been late 70s, early 80s. So the last vestiges of the Jewish community were completely gone.
So Portuguese people moved in, and Italian people, were they moving too?
And the Italian people were also moving too.
Leaving.
And they were leaving to either go to St. Clair or to the beginnings of Woodbridge as we know it today.
So what was that about this?
The movement, you mean?
Yeah.
The movement was simple. The movement was that all of those houses represented their beginning. Their future lay beyond that. They wanted to make their way away. And my dad, interestingly enough, though we had the restaurant and we were pretty settled, we weren't going to go anywhere, said to me, it's so funny that, you know, I left the farming community and to be going north again, like everyone, because at the time when all the Italians were moving to Woodbridge, there wasn't very much development still up there. It was quite open. His dad, of course, when he first arrived early on with a lot of his Italian buddies, would go hunting. And they would hunt for all kinds of things in southern Ontario. But most of the Italians had, you know, back in the mid-80s at this point, had pretty much left. There weren't very many left.
But your family stayed.
We stayed.
What was that about? The restaurant?
The restaurant. The restaurant was our stable. But my father at the same time realized that he had made the best choice of all time because... he didn't need a car.
Yeah.
He could walk out his door. He could still go down to the market. And at the time, of course, it was still the Jewish market. I remember it as a child as a Jewish market. This Kensington market stuff is still kind of freaky for me.
Tell me.
I still go and see the Zimmerman family, where Zimmerman still is. And the son's there. The father comes by every once in a while. And I'll say to him, I said, what the hell happened? He says, Mario, I don't know what to tell you. These times have changed. But, yeah.
Now, what store is Zimmerman's store?
It's right across the street from... it's on Augusta, and it's right where Augusta meets Baldwin. There's a coffee place. Across the street from the coffee place on Augusta are the Zimmermans.
And what kind of store is that?
They sell everything in there.
Okay, I know that store.
He's got groceries, clothes, yeah. Underwear, you name it. Whatever you need. In fact,
you want cheap
you see
and underwear?
Shirts?
Yeah, from Zimmerman's.
Made in Italy.
Yeah.
He imports them. They're called Moretti.
Yes.
And they're $10 a pop. And I buy boxes of them. And he's the only guy that'll buy them, or that gets them for me. He's an amazing guy. Him and his father are credible. We go in there all the time.
Did your family use the market much?
Oh, all the time. Everything we bought for the restaurant
was
really? The Jewish market. Mr. Produce. Mr. Produce was otherwise known as something else in the market. And then later, they ended up buying a larger warehouse and they were purveying food directly from the market to the warehouse. And they started dealing with restaurants and other supermarkets and things. But they were initially a Jewish family that started off just selling fruits and vegetables in the market that grew. And they came to be known as Mr. Produce.
Yes.
And I think they're still in business, if I'm not mistaken. But my dad had developed a relationship with them when they were just a little store on Kensington. And then we continued to deal with them for years and years and years afterwards.
But you did your shopping in the market.
In the market.
So you must have had some vendors that were your
regulars.
My dad
would go in there and, you know, next thing you know, we'd have bushels of peppers, we'd have bushels of this and bushels of that. And it was like, oh my God, Dad, you're buying so much. But I got a good price on everything. I said, okay, good. Okay, so, you know, but we have to consume this product. Because often getting a good price meant, you know, I'll give you a good price. You know, I got to get rid of it, whatever. And so anyway, he ended up developing all these relationships with everybody in the Bloody Market. Everybody. And at the time, you know, of course, it was predominantly Jewish. It wasn't, you know, what it is today. So, you know, it was in a way, I mean, it got to a point where they started to come to us and, you know, they were delivering product to us. So my father could talk to them and say, can you get me this? Can you get me that? So it was really easy. It was just so easy to get everything. And I imagine Ideal Foods that was run at the corner of College and Bathurst was a Jewish-owned restaurant supplier. And the last name of the family, if I'm not mistaken, was Weber. And I'll never forget, they had an Italian man working for them called Mr. Tedesco, who actually helped us build our restaurant. And it's amazing how he put it all together. I mean, what did my dad know about restaurants, right? So this Italian man who worked for a Jewish company that was a restaurant supplier helped us set up our restaurant. And they were, I mean, you remember Ideal Foods? They were at Bathurst and College for so many years.
I'm not sure.
And the two brothers, Mark, oh God, Mark and, what was his name? I can't forget. Sure, they've passed away at this point.
But they were the Ideal Food owners?
Yes, they were the owners. Mark, and I can see his face in my head because I go there all the time. And anyway, so they were it. They were the supplier. They were the best of the best. These guys were setting up restaurants everywhere. And just, you know, where Cromer Radio is now, just north of Cromer Radio, Ideal Foods had another kind of building there where they actually manufactured canopy hoods for restaurants and all kinds of other things. They were growing. But eventually, you know, I guess they all got kind of old and said, hell with it.
What are the changes that you see in our neighborhood, Harbor Village? What are the big changes that you see?
There's certainly a lot of new blood that's in the neighborhood, but it doesn't feel as community-like. It doesn't feel as tight. It doesn't feel the way it felt when I was a child. As much as we had, you know, it was a tough time, you know, families were genuine, so much more genuine. There wasn't any money. Mm-hmm. When you don't have wealth, what else have you got? What do you turn to? You turn to someone's smile because they're inviting you, because they want to make contact. You invite the world inside your life because the world is so tough, I suppose. But as it became gentrified, I think that's a better word, or yuppified, or whatever you want to call it, it became a little bit more distant and a little bit more isolated. It's not quite as tight as it used to be. You got to bear in mind, I walk out my bloody door, and across the street there was an Italian tailor. I'd walk out my door, I'd go left, and I'd see the Harbor Bakery with Albert and Goldie. I'd go further, and it was the Harbor Street Fish Market. I'd go further, and there was Greenspan, who was smoking the best turkey in the city of Toronto.
That's all on the south side.
All
of
on the
Harvard.
South side. So, you know, it was just and it was like the number of shoemakers.
On Harbor.
On Harbor. Yeah. Right across the street from us, the shoemaker.
And the fish market?
Harbor Fish Co., the two Jewish brothers, they hate each other. But they used to come in, you know, I'll never forget this, as a child, an enormous tractor trailer, like the vessel would look like, you know, the milk vessels that they used to fill milk, full of white fish.
Whoa.
And this entire thing, I don't know where they found the room, it would be dumped into the basement of the Harbor Fish Co., which was right next door to the Harbor Bakery, and they would smoke it. And I don't know how much fish they smoked, but they smoked a lot of fish.
And then they sold all that.
And they sold all that fish. Yeah.
So that was part of your growing up, that fish store.
Yeah. And then unloading like these enormous vessels of like fresh, live fish.
Was that part of the entertainment for the kids?
Well, the entertainment was watching what were their names?
What?
David, I think. David and Harry or something like that.
The two brothers who hated each other?
Oh, man, they fought like cats and dogs. It was unbelievable.
So that was the entertainment.
Well, I mean, but the thing is, they were busy. They had an incredibly busy place. I mean, it was really important.
So nobody ate there. It was just to come and take.
Like, so they had all the gefilte fish they had. All the, like, the really, really...
good Jewish fish.
Yeah, real Jewish fish. Yeah. And that's what they were amazing.
Okay, so what other stores were there in Harvard now that you're talking about?
Well, Greenspan and Son... that were at the corner of Brunswick and Harvard on the northwest corner, which is where Clay Design is. And if you look at the building, it's kind of funny because you'll see there's like an outbuilding at the back that used to be Michael's Muscles years ago. Uh-huh. Michael's was the first guy to bring in real PEI muscles into the city of Toronto. Anyway, but our Thanksgiving at the Peretta family.
Yes.
Was one of Greenspan and Son's smoked turkey. And I will never forget it. It was the tastiest turkey you will ever have in your entire life. And then right next door, going north on Harvard, there was a very small Jewish pharmacy. Very, very small. And I'll never forget being very young and going in there with my dad or my mom to pick up prescription drugs or whatever they were. But it was like, and if you worked your way up north along Brunswick, there was a very small synagogue that I remember clearly as a child. And
is that the one that's there now? There's one just north of Harvard.
Yeah, that's the one. That's right. And then across the street, mm-hmm. on the other side, was a house that had a front part where they just sold chickens and eggs. Just chickens and eggs. That's all they sold.
And did they kill the chickens on the spot?
Yeah.
Or
Yeah, because the reason... why I know this is because we all went to St. Peter's, which used to be at the corner of Bathurst and Bloor. So part of our walk was along Harvard. We'd walk up Brunswick, then across Sussex, and then up Limpincott and off to St. Peter's.
Same route every day.
Uh-huh. So there were all these stores.
You knew those stores very well.
I saw them every single day. Every single day. It's amazing.
Those have changed because now it's lots of restaurants.
You know, it's really funny. I mean, I think we've regressed. Honestly, when you think about it, you walk out the door and there's all the food in the world. I mean, everybody was making food. It was just different. And everything was wholesome. I mean, there are shoemakers, there are people smoking fish and people smoking chickens and turkeys and the Harvard Drapery baking bread.
A big variety of stuff.
Oh my God, there was so much. And there was even a music shop across the street from where Peretta's is now, just slightly east. And it was a music shop, and I forget the name of it now. And a European man, I forget his background, but he sold everything from harmonicas to accordions to guitars, and my uncle loved that store. He would go in there and he just loved it. He just sold all these incredible musical instruments. That was the thing.
Now, I know your family worked hard and the children worked too, but when you did occasionally play, where did you play as children?
Well, that's a really good question. Well, lots of things that we did. We'd go to Central Tech. They had the big oval course at Central Tech. Uh-huh. And just after the buildings all got knocked down north of Sussex on Robert Street, which is now behind what used to be Dominion or Metro, mm-hmm. was that big square, because that was all run by the University of Toronto, we would play there. Or the other thing we would do is we'd go to Queen's Park. In Queen's Park, you got to bear in mind, in the winter months, they used to flood all, like, three or four little areas, and we could go skating inside Queen's Park. Lots of areas to go and skate. But we would climb trees at Queen's Park. Of course, we'd get, you know, reprimanded by the police and who knows what. But we'd play ball hockey on the street.
Right on Harvard, right on Robert.
Right on Robert.
On Robert Street.
Oh, yeah. Right
what
on Robert.
What about the lane? Did you use the lane?
Yeah, we used the lane all the time.
Playing in the lane?
Yeah, we played.
Did you play?
Often it was hockey or soccer. What else did we do? I mean, we were mischievous too. My brothers and I all got into machines and cars and motorcycles, and we would build go-karts and did all kinds of things.
So you built them yourselves?
Oh, yeah.
And did your parents or your uncle Giorgio help you with that?
No, but they assisted us. So far as I'll never forget, my dad actually salvaged an old coal-burning stove, which he put in our garage to keep us warm, because he would say, my kids are always working in that garage. They're making things. So he found this thing. And
so he saw that there was value in that.
Oh, yeah.
Creating things.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. So we were, I mean, for example, I love motorcycles, of which the story is, as I told you, my dad promised that he would buy me one.
Tell me that story.
And of course, you know, we all worked. We didn't get paid. And I said to my dad, Dad, you know, I really want a motorcycle. And he said, your next birthday, you know, on that day, I'll buy you a motorcycle. And he's bang on the money, you know. On that day, he took me out to McBride Cycle. He said, point at which one you want, and I will buy it for you. And I did. And I bought my first RM Suzuki 125. And I was in heaven. Because I didn't have a driver's license. I was too young for that. And, of course, I would terrorize the neighborhood with it. And it was really
with
loud.
With no license.
With no license. But then I ended up going to Etobicoke, Centennial Park at the time, and they had a off-road course for kids that wanted to ride. So it was like $75. I forget what it was for the whole weekend. So my brother Pat had bought one, and I had one. And we would go there in motorbike for hours and hours and hours. It was great fun. So
you worked hard, but you also knew how to play.
Oh, yeah. We knew how to play.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we didn't. We weren't. I mean, thankfully. Oh my God! Thankfully, we never got involved in drugs. Oh Jesus! Because I saw lots of kids pass away, overdoses. You name it. It was awful. It was a really tough time, and there was all kinds of weird drugs that were going around in those days. It wasn't just marijuana. There was all kinds. I mean, it wasn't just heroin. And cocaine was impossible in those days because nobody could ever afford it. But there were weird drugs like MDMA. No, MDA. There was one called MDA. And there was, oh, God. And people were just, I mean, I think it was, again, you know, the immigrant community was just really having a hard time. And there's no question that drugs were there to kind of, you know, bridge some gap or to deal with their realities. And maybe
the adolescents or the parents?
The adolescents.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the parents were hard on them. I know that some of the Portuguese parents were very physically abusive with their kids. And certainly, thank God, that never happened with my mom and dad. My mother and father would never touch us. They were so calm.
So they were modern in that respect.
My mother had a father who was horrible, who was violent and vicious, and would beat up her mother. And I think she swore that she would never lay a finger on her children. And my father never came from that at all. My father's family were so completely decent. Nobody screamed. Nobody yelled.
So your family really was an active family with four boys, but no violence.
No violence. No, no, no.
I remember your father on his big tricycle.
Oh, God.
Up and down the street. I was on Robert Street, of course.
He was just the softest, quietest man. He would never raise his voice, never lifted his fingers on us. He was never loud. He was never, he's just such a good man.
Yeah, a gentle person.
Very gentle, very quiet, not physically aggressive. Like, he wouldn't, you know, need to hug you and shake you or any of that stuff at all. And in fact, I think sometimes I kind of felt sorry for my mom, because I thought, maybe he's just not that affectionate. And because he wasn't, you know, but he kept to himself and he didn't say very much and he was very quiet. Which was fine.
That was his nature.
That was his nature.
Did you have a back garden, a back lawn at all, where you lived?
Before we had the addition on the restaurant, we did have a backyard. And, of course, we always had parsley, basil, the odd tomato or two, because the gardens weren't terribly big. Uh-huh. But my father was always so happy about, look at the soil. It's so black. Uh-huh. It's so healthy.
Because he was a farmer and he appreciated that.
And you imagine, I mean, Sicily was the breadbasket. So all of the nutrients were raped out during the times of the Romans, right? So the soil was dead. There was nothing in it. So Ryan, of course, he comes to Canada and he sees this black soil.
And he's
like, wow, look at the soil. It's black. So, yeah, he was a farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
He really was.
What about heating of your homes? Do you remember changes that in the years that you were there, or is that not significant?
No, I mean, it's significant. We, at the time, we had a boiler. It was a boiler. It was an oil-fed boiler. Never forget it. Always stunk every time the oil truck came by to fill up oil in our house. But you probably remember that. That's the way it was in those days. There was no natural gas. It was all oil.
But it wasn't coal. The coal was already gone.
Coal was gone at that point. But the chutes were still there.
Uh-huh.
All the chutes. In fact, 97 Harbor Street, imagine, when we took over the restaurant or the building that Joe Polacco had, the patio was a boulevard, and the city of Toronto were allowed to have livestock. So if you had a building like the Boulevard Cafe or Peretta's or the convenience store now, it used to be Fuda's, for example, all of those were often operated by supermarkets and butchers because you were allowed to have livestock up there, which was one of the things that we had to fight for when we got our patio license, because that law was still in effect. And as my lawyer at the time said, well, then what we should do is go out and rent a couple of cows, a couple of sheep, and a couple of goats, put them on the patio, and it'll show the city of Toronto how draconian their laws are, and they need to be changed.
Yeah.
It's a true story. Oh, it's just crazy. Yeah. That's what was going on. It was a very, very interesting period of time. Well, I just lost my train of thought. What am I thinking about? But College Street, you see, was also interesting too, in the sense that, you know, again, if I went, my mother would take us shopping to buy clothes on College. And the college at the time was, again, a mixture of Jewish and Italian shopkeepers. And so there was a lot of variety. I mean, a lot of the clothes that were being imported at the time were also of Italian background, and most of the purveyors who had only been here, you know, for, you know, under 10 years, for example, when we were kids growing up, didn't speak very much English, but boy, could he speak a lot of Italian. So we had our own community. We really did. It's
who learned Italian? From what you remember, did the mothers of your friends speak English better, or the fathers speak English better?
Oh, the fathers, of course.
The fathers learned English.
Yeah.
And the mothers didn't?
No.
Because they were at home more?
In fact, my first language was Italian, not English.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, I couldn't figure out why I had such a tough time in grades 1, 2, and 3. It's because I didn't know how to speak English.
So you spoke Italian with your family and your community?
Yeah. I was growing up, and my mom and dad, and they really only spoke Italian.
Uh-huh.
They spoke very, at the time, they spoke awful English. If anything, right? So, yeah, my first language was not English, it was Italian, even though I was born and raised here.
Yeah.
It was crazy. But that's the way it was. But I do have to say, though, as tough as it may have been in those days, there was a lot more community. But I mean, community that meant something. It was just different. It was so, it was warming. It was warm. It was warm. It was genuine. And you got to know these people because these people were in your face and you saw them every day and they had big, bad personalities because they needed to have big, bad personalities to survive. They couldn't hide in their homes. To survive meant you had to go out into the streets and you had to go out there and open up your shop and you had to be the good Jewish butcher or the good Italian butcher or whatever. You needed to go out and face the world. You couldn't hide. So money, you know, was so scarce that people were out. They were out there and you got to know everybody very, very quickly and it was in your face. The world was happening beautifully and it felt very much. In fact, my Uncle George, before he went back to Italy, you know, because he retired there and didn't want to live here anymore, he said, you know, do you remember those days? It was beautiful.
So he liked it. It was intense.
Yeah.
It was difficult, but he liked it.
Yeah, because there was, you know, a strong Italian community, there was a strong Jewish community. You know, and you could do real business, you know. You could really talk to these people. And they weren't going to screw you over because, you know, you live right down the street and he knows him and she knows that guy and everybody knows everybody, you know. It wasn't this, you weren't isolated. You weren't doing business because you were just a number. You were doing business with Mr. and Mrs. Peretta and they know Mr. and Mrs. Giannotti who knows Mr. and Mrs. Schwartz who know Mr. and Mrs. Zimmerman who know. So everything was like...
Yeah.
The credibility.
It was close, it was intense, it was vibrant.
Yeah, it was alive. Yeah. It was alive. And that doesn't exist today. It's gone.
You use the word gentrified.
Yeah.
So people have kind of come in back into their homes.
Which is what money does. I'm working in Rosedale. My God, people don't even say hello. They're walking their dogs. They're looking up at the sky, or they're looking down at the ground. No one faces anybody and says, buongiorno.
Yeah. Well, I know when I moved to Robert Street about 25 years ago, and I was a neighbor, we sat out on our front porches a lot, until 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning.
Why not?
Yeah, a lot of front porch sitting.
Yeah. That's the way it was.
Yeah.
It was fine. People were outside. I mean, we'd be running the restaurant, and we had the back area, of course, which is where we cooked, and the front was the restaurant, and, you know, it'd be like 8:30, 9 o'clock, and, you know, Joe Stein would walk in the door. Hey, how you guys doing? Is everything okay? Joe, you want something? Could you make me a black coffee? Sure, I'll bring you a black coffee. Hold on. I'd bring him a black coffee. And he'd hang out. He'd hang out in the kitchen with us until 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
And then he'd go home.
Yeah.
And that was Joe's.
So it was a real sense of we.
Yeah.
And community.
Yeah.
A tight one.
It was a different time. And people really, I really miss the personalities.
Characters.
Yeah.
Like, where are you living now?
I'm living above the restaurant. And I am.
Yeah.
I am, importantly, because that is and was our family residence. And it's really important from the point of view of what's the right word, preserving the fact that that was our family home. And I think part of the importance of it also is that if we had to, say, turn around tomorrow and rent it all out, like the base floor is rented as a restaurant, which is fine, I think the government would deem it to be a fully commercial building, and we would, once my mother passes away, inherit it, we would get nailed with capital gains. Which my accountant said to me, you've got to be really careful because it's on a commercial street. I know you guys grew up there. I know you shared beds there. But when your mom's gone, they may want to come after you for taxes, which is really, I mean, given what we paid for it and what it's worth today, I might just give it to them. Give it to the government, because the difference is so ginormous. You'd almost pay more than 50% of it would be tax. So I said, you know what? I'm not leaving that property. I am not leaving that property. That is our family house. That's where we were raised. And they can call this whatever the hell they want to call this. We shared bedrooms in this house for years and years and years.
Okay, this is 2013, and you've been living in this particular house. Building since, and what's your address there?
95 Harvard.
Okay.
95 and 97.
Okay. And you moved there in what year?
Well, I've been there most of my life. Yeah. I've had, like, you know, periods where I lived away from the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I came back to live. I bought my own house, which I lived in for about 8 years with a woman that I was married to, and that unfortunately ended. And then sold the house and lived in an apartment for a short time, and then realized that my mother and father were getting on in years and they needed help. And I was, of course, single. I was now in my mid to late 30s. And I said, you know what? The building's big enough. I'm going to make myself a nice little apartment and I'm going to live right here.
So you had your own separate space.
So I had my own separate space, lived in the same building with mom and dad, and if they needed help, I was there to do it for them. If they needed groceries, I was there to buy them for them. And more often than not, you know what, we ate together. You know, I'd cook, they'd cook, we'd cook. I had my autonomy, I had my independence, I had my privacy, but I didn't have to run away from my parents. I mean, you know, I think there's this, like, this whole thing in North American thinking where, you know, you get to a certain age in life and it's important that you disconnect yourself from your family. Well, that's not part of Italian culture. We keep each other close. You know, if in Italy, for example, it's not unusual to see grandparents living in the same house as their daughters or sons, and whose, you know, granddaughters and grandsons are also living in the same house.
Well, I think what you're saying is you can be close and you can live close to each other but still be independent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. My mother and father would never put their nose in my business. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They gave me autonomy. They gave me my freedom. They never made me feel like I was, you know, I wasn't doing whatever I was supposed to do. They were wonderful. And it's funny, it was tough as a child growing up because, you know, of course, Canadian culture is like, you're still living at home? Not really.
Very judgmental. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. What's your feeling about how safe the neighborhood is now?
I don't feel it's safe just because I don't feel I have no identity in this area anymore. I don't feel like I know enough people to make a difference anymore. In the past, I knew people from Borden Street, I knew people on Limpincott, I knew people on Major, I knew people on Brunswick, I knew people on Robert, I knew people north of Robert, I knew people south of Robert, I knew everybody, and everybody knew us. And so we all kind of knew each other. I don't feel that anymore. So I would say that it was safer when I was growing up, as far as I was concerned, because everybody knew everybody.
Yeah. It was a real sense, a real community. Yeah.
You wouldn't be screwing around in this neighborhood if you were from another neighborhood. We'd know it right away. Mm-hmm. We would know. It's like, hey, you know who I saw? I saw so-and-so. What are they doing here? They don't belong here. They're like College Street. They're college in Lippincott. Or they're college in Manning. Oh, I know those guys.
They don't belong here. They're up to trouble.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, we just knew because we were on the streets. We were outside. Yeah. We weren't inside houses watching TV or in front of a computer. We were on the street.
I remember when I lived on Robert Street, Mario was already. You remember
Mario? Yeah, yeah, little Mario.
He sat at
So he would know. He would watch all the stuff going by. Yeah, yeah, so he would say, hey, you know, I saw this or, hey, I saw that. Yeah. But imagine that tenfold. And that's what it was like when I was growing up. So everybody was out. Everybody.
So everybody watched it for each other.
So yeah, I would say it was definitely safer then. And because some of the stuff that I hear about now would never in a million years ever happen. Ever. Just because kids that would be in this neighborhood would say, you know, we got to really be careful. There's, you know, there's people here that are going to really bust our balls if we don't, you know, if we don't behave. Like we just can't go in there and do that kind of stuff. That's not going to happen. Because if so-and-so finds out, oh my God, we're finished.
Yeah. So everybody was watching it.
Yeah.
And both generations were doing it.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments about the university being our neighbor, just the other side of Spadina?
The university, if it wasn't for the university, would never have been able to sustain our business. Those kids kept us alive and for years and years and years. There's no question that students of the day, when we were in business early on, were great. They were wonderful people. It was a different time. It was never loud. It was never the loud, drunken Brunswick house kind of period where you'd see, you know, a lot of, you know, belligerent stuff taking place. It wasn't like that at all. Not when I remembered it.
So for your family, the university was good, and the students were...
The professors ate there, the faculty, of course, ate there, the students all ate there.
Yeah, yeah. And they behaved well.
And they were all wonderful. In fact, one of the students was our architect who helped us build the restaurant, helped us get all the designs that we needed. And for years and years and years while we're still open, we'd had them all coming in and visiting us. The Bauman family, for example, Peter, who was wonderful, I forget him and his wife, and I forget when they first got married, and you know, they'd come into our restaurant when they were just students, and they were lovely, and they now live somewhere in the US, but still visited quite regularly, and there were very strong family ties. So no, the university wasn't a problem for us. It was actually a really fantastic influence, and everybody, the faculty and the students were fantastic. No complaints. They were good.
Do you remember when they changed the streets, you know, going this way, that way?
Oh, I do.
What was that like?
Pandemonium. Couldn't stand it. Hated it. Felt like it was like shoved down our throats. Didn't really have a say in the matter. Mm-hmm. It just happened. But that was, you know, typical. You're in a European neighborhood. You can do whatever the hell you want. We're just a bunch of immigrants. How could we ever stand up on our own 2 feet and fight? So it was one of those situations where I just felt like we were just bulldozed. didn't really have a choice in the matter, which I thought was just so completely unfair. You just go ahead and decide on your own.
So you you weren't consulted?
No, hell no. Uh-huh. They just went ahead. One day it was like, oh my God, the directions have all changed.
Yeah, yeah. So it was inconvenient for your family, I guess.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
I hated it. I couldn't go down the street. We had cars, we had motorcycles, we had, you know, what's wrong with the street being in one direction? And what's wrong if the streets are being used as arteries? It's a city. You're going to create a quiet, tidy little neighborhood in the middle of downtown Toronto? We grew up and it was wild. And all of a sudden you're trying to tame it?
Yeah.
Don't kill it. So I think it was all yuppified, you know. All of a sudden there's new people, they bring in money, they have power, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they think they own the world.
So that was a change that you felt was not for the better.
No.
For you.
We never had a voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And never really missed having a voice, and just kind of minded our own business and just did our thing.
Is there anything we haven't talked about? I mean, when you and I chatted on the phone and then when you came in, I mean, you have so many good stories and so many life experiences that you cherish.
There
were some difficult ones, but you certainly...
The Black Sea Fish Market, corner of Clinton and College. Bought from a Jewish man, owned now by, well, at the time, owned by a Greek guy, Andreas. I never forget going there with my dad to buy sardines on Fridays only, because Fridays are when the sardines came in. And he would save them for us. And my dad and I would walk from Harvard and Spadina College and Manning to buy fish.
That was for the restaurant?
No,
for us. For your home?
For the family. Are you kidding? You can never serve sardines in a restaurant. We tried so many times to actually introduce typical Southern Italian fare. Oh my God, nobody wanted anything to do with it. Because our clientele wasn't Italian.
Uh-huh.
It was a mixture of all different kinds of people. Yeah. But we tried everything. We tried black ink pasta. We tried pasta with sardines. We tried, oh my God, all these crazy old Italian dishes. And the neighborhood, or at least the clientele, they weren't going to eat it. They just weren't going
to
eat it.
Well, you weren't going to continue to buy them if nobody was going to eat them.
No, but my father would make some pretty deadly sweet and sour sardines.
For the family.
Oh, yeah, they were good.
Yeah. Oh, caramelized. Both your parents were good cooks.
Oh, yeah. Caramelized those onions, and it would be like God, they were so good. Because, you know, they would be in the fridge. They would always be in the fridge. They would always be cold. You could always take them out and have one or two of them. And they were so filling and so yummy. Oh, my God. Those days.
When you when you walked in tonight, you were telling me this wonderful
pasta dish
that you made for your mother.
Puttanesca. Black olives, capers, black currants, saffron, sun-dried tomatoes, garlic, fresh basil, salt, pepper, splash.
Both of us have not had dinner. I don't think you're doing us a favor.
No, I'm going to go and have dinner after this. But no, I make food for my mom like once or twice a week, just in case. And it's in the fridge, so my caregiver knows that if my mom doesn't have dinner at the nursing home, she's always got a little bit of backup.
Uh-huh.
So.
But both your parents were good cooks, and you too are a fine cook.
You know what? It's really weird because I'll never forget, my dad passed away for some strange reason, because every fall is olive season, not just in Canada / California, which is where they come from. It's also that in Italy. And so the year he passed away, before he passed away, I don't know what I was thinking, but I went to Fiesta Farms, and I know there's a lot of Italians that go there. And they had a couple of cases of olives, and I bought olives. And I wanted to, I knew he was dying, and I didn't want to let go of those traditions. So I bought those green olives, and you can make them in one of the two ways that we would do them. We would crush them, just crush the bone, but not remove the bone, and soak them in water. for 2 or 3 days, and then you get the bitterness out of them. Then you can add garlic and spices and olive oil and all kinds of things. Or you could cure them whole with the olive pit in them in brine. And so for some bizarre reason, here he was dying, and I went out and bought 2 cases of green olives and prepared them all, and it was in my apron. I was covered in green sludge all over me. Because in a way, I guess him dying was a dying tradition, because it wasn't one fall that ever went by. But while he was alive, that he and I and Mom wouldn't sit there for hours crushing olives. And of course, Nick and Sylvia would get their jars, and Sal would get his, and my brother Pat would get his, but we would make food for everybody. And so we used to buy pork rind, like bacon, pancetta, and my dad would cure it, of course, and they'd get that, or we'd make sausage. Mario, I'm making sausage. You want to come over?
That's your father calling.
Uh-huh. Dad, you got everything you need? Yeah, I just need you and your hands. Come over. So I'd go over there, and we'd make, I don't know how many Lynx sausages, of which some you could, you know, he would dry, some of which he would keep fresh, some of he'd freeze. But that was a typical Italian tradition. I mean, food was really, really, really important.
So you learned about food from your parents.
Oh, totally.
And you learned about all this beautiful work you do with wood from your Uncle George.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
George was amazing.
Yeah. Are there any stories that you came thinking, oh, I better include that? Maybe it's hard to think of it at the moment.
Oh, there's great stories. There's all these wonderful individuals. You know Ziggy and his mother. Good old Ziggy. His mother was Jewish, his father was Hungarian. And he was Hungarian-Jewish. She was, she wasn't Hungarian. She was Polish. She was a Polish-Jewish woman. And he wasn't a very nice man. But Ziggy was a nice guy. Ziggy and Herschel was Mr. Stein, the tailor's son. And Ziggy, forget Ziggy's last name.
But that's who lived at 158 Robert before I moved in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. But no, that was the neighborhood. We grew up and we all made it all happen.
You all felt you belonged. There was a real connectedness.
There wasn't a feeling. You know what's really interesting? Because I didn't feel or hear the terminologies of racial distinction and differences until we were like probably 16 or 17, sort of in high school. Because before that, as kids growing up, there was no, you're not this or you're not that, or it was just different. It was, and because everybody, again, we're all immigrants, right? So nobody really had territory. It was the Canadians that were tough on us. And that's what we really fought. That's what I felt we really fought. We fought them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really,
immigrants were being attacked, and you fought back.
Yeah, and the immigrants stuck together. So it was no wonder that the Jewish community and the Italian community got along, because we were both being kicked in the teeth.
Mm. So you have clear memories about that.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But
being beaten up was not an easy thing to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. Did it make you tougher?
Absolutely,
it did.
Yeah, don't push me around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we're going to come back and we're going to do some to you. Don't do this to us. So we were tough. I mean, you've heard of the Christy Pitt riots.
Yes.
That was a perfect example of the Italian Jewish community. You know, I mean, the only people that would hire Italians were Jews. Canadians weren't going to hire us. That's just the way it was. So they were in a bind. They were winning the baseball game, you know, and the English started beating them up. And the Jewish community picked up the phone and called the Italians, their employees. And they all went to Christy Pitt's. And those are the Christy Pitt riots.
You know, I knew about the riots. I didn't know what you just told me.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I phoned their Italian friends and said,
Yeah, and they went over and they beat the living bejesus out of all these white, trashy people that were beating up on the Jewish community. That were hiring us. And they were giving us jobs.
Who was giving you jobs?
The Jewish community.
The Jewish people were giving you jobs.
Yeah.
Okay, Mario, we're going to stop.
Yeah.
Mario Peretta, thank you so much.
Oh,
what a delight this has been. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure, Eleanor. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure.